I'm Judy Swallow in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. If you want to learn about criminals, the best teacher is an ex-con. That's the boast of a group of profs who got a lot of their education behind bars. The college campus is no stranger to former offenders, but in the past, they put their past behind them. Now they publicize it and use it. Freshmen will go to their first lecture on criminology to hear a confession and this promise. They'll hear about the prison system from the inside, in the language of jails, brutal and profane. And it's not just at the rostrum that the ex-con shines. He's a prized research tool for academe, getting prisoners to open up and reveal real-life stories of incarceration. But read those first-hand accounts and it's a diatribe of distress and despair. Quite, say the criminologists, without the criminal record. The ex-con has an agenda. In one line, that the whole system stinks. And you don't have to go to prison to understand it. Connection listeners, is first-hand experience essential to understanding or a prejudicial barrier to knowledge? Can only ex-cons understand the prison system? Only women understand women's issues, gays on gay issues, blacks on racism? 1-800-423-8255 is the number to call to join the conversation. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined from Cincinnati by Stephen Richards. He's a professor of sociology and criminology at Northern Kentucky University and co-editor of the book Convict Criminology. He was convicted of conspiracy to distribute marijuana and incarcerated for 3 years. Professor Richards, thanks for joining us. Your contribution to that book, your life in the federal prison system, is grueling reading. Just tell us a bit of the touchstones, the revelations to you in your experience going through the federal prison system. Let's start with bail.
Well, the big surprise is that when a person is arrested by the federal government is that the bail is so high and that few people actually get bail. And that few people actually have a trial because they're broken and they're forced to confess and they're forced to plea bargain. And something like 95% of all federal defendants actually will plead guilty. Not so much because they are guilty, but because of they can't make bail, the bail's too high, they can't afford attorneys, and they're unable to defend themselves.
Tell us about yourself before you were convicted. I mean, you weren't a professor before, were you?
Well, my background is somewhat unusual in that I grew up in an orphanage, so I have no mother, no father. And I attended the University of Wisconsin-Madison, which had the top program in sociology in the country. And when I actually was going through trial, I was actually a senior undergrad student in sociology at the University of Wisconsin.
So you're well-educated, middle class, before you actually were going to jail?
Well, I'm not sure I was middle class. I mean, I am an orphan, but I certainly had a middle-class education, you know, at an elite public university.
So really wide-open, informed eyes going into this system, which you've described as a netherworld.
Well, I don't think most Americans realize that when anybody goes to prison, be it federal prison or state prison, everything they leave on the street is up for grabs. That means their family, their marriages, their children. Once they get to prison, most of them will lose everything. The first pain of imprisonment is that loss, the loss of family and the loss of place in society. And when you enter prison, it's a big world. It's a different world. As you say, another world. It's like going to another planet. There's maximum security, medium security, minimum security. And when you get there, you have to adjust to that environment and to that lifestyle of being a prison inmate. And it's a difficult adjustment for anybody, be they working class, middle class, be they rich or poor.
You were married when you went in, not lost your wife while you're in there, didn't you?
Well, I was married. I had a home. I had a job. My son had been born 2 weeks before I was arrested. And my wife had a nervous breakdown. I landed up losing my family, which meant everything to me because at the time, that was the only family I had. I spent 2 years on bail. I had a jury trial in the Strom Thurmond Courthouse in Charleston, South Carolina, where from the courtroom you could see Fort Sumter in the distance, and they flew a Confederate flag from the courthouse. I stood trial. I was in court for 25 months. I was on bail for 25 months, where I had to report to a parole officer every day, 7 days a week for 25 months. I had a 3-day jury trial in which I was had been indicted on 10 counts of conspiracy to distribute marijuana in a case with no marijuana, no possession, no sale. And in effect, the federal government wanted me to testify against other people, and I refused to cooperate. I refused to participate in the destruction of other people.
Tell us about the brutalizing and dehumanizing impact of jail. I mean, some of the worst things are just being transported from one jail to another, your life totally out of your hands.
Well, first I did jail time in Charleston, South Carolina, and Columbia, South Carolina. Those jails were segregated. They had white cells and black cells. Because I was from Wisconsin, I was a Yankee. I was locked in the cells with African-American prisoners, which was fine with me. I probably had more in common with them, actually. I then was transported to Atlanta Penitentiary. I was a first-time offender. I had a marijuana conviction, and I was sentenced to a United States penitentiary. That's maximum security. And in the course of the 3 years that I was actually in prison, I did time in 9 different prisons in 6 different states. And the reason was because in the early 1980s, at the beginning of the drug war, the federal prison system only had about 25,000 prisoners. Today they have 170,000. In 1984, when I entered the federal prison system, it was so crowded, it was so jammed with prisoners that they really were not adhering to their own rules of classification. So that meant that first-time offenders could land up in a maximum security.
Tell me about the prison guards, the staff in prisons. Do you regard them as the enemy, a sort of just a venomous group of persecutors?
No, I don't. I mean, you know, prison guards, correctional officers, they're just men and women that they need employment, they need a job. You can't, it's not like a baseball game. You can't divide people by the uniform they wear. Human beings on either side are decent, good people. I mean, I need to say this, so that the reason I'm a professor today is because of some of the decent, humane prison guards who helped me while I was in prison and who made things available to me so that I could get books, so that I could get my mail, even at times to get me out of the hole, to get me out of solitary confinement. So, yeah, there are a lot of decent decent prison guards that do help prisoners. On the other hand, you know, within the system itself, the what we call prison guards, we call them hacks. The hacks and the inmates are generally at odds with each other. Because they don't know each other as people, because they see each other as separate categories.
What about your relationship with the fellow inmates? Good, bad, brutalized, victimizing, bullying?
Well, I grew up in an orphanage, so I'm a pretty collective individual. You know, I make friends fast. And I entered prison pretty well. I could take care of myself. You know, I'm 6 feet tall. I'm pretty heavily built. So I didn't have a problem. And actually in prison, it needs to be said that the convicts actually in the federal system get along rather well with each other. That's not to say there's not stress and there's not conflict, but most of the prisoners, most of the time, are courteous to each other and generally polite.
Professor Richards, you've painted a grueling picture of prison life, and actually to read your experiences is worse. Having gone through that, what makes you want to be a professor of criminology?
Well, I think that it's important to have a more realistic look at prisons. And I think in order to do that, that we have to give the convicts a voice. We have to give them a chance to tell us what it's like inside. I think that in departments of criminology and criminal justice at universities across the country, that we should have an intellectual space for former prison guards, former police officers, prosecutors, and former prison inmates who have completed PhDs and entered the university as professors. And we should be having a conversation, a discussion, much as we are today, amongst these people who have inside and professional experience.
To what end? What do they add beyond perhaps a collective indictment of the system?
Well, I'm not indicting the system. I would say that there's too many people in prison and they're serving too much time. There's 2 million people in prison today, 2.2 million. The prison population since 1970 has gone up 10 times, 1,000%. This is a lot of people. I mean, 2.1 million people means that there's 10 million family members out there waiting for their sons, daughters, mothers, and fathers to come home.
Professor Richards, you don't quite sound like a pure academic to me. You sound slightly like an advocate of change. Is being a professor really the way you want to express what you went through?
Well, I'm a professor. I'm an academic. I have three college degrees. I do both quantitative and qualitative research. That's the role I play. That's my professional role. But I'm also an advocate and for policy change, to enter into the media, for example, to discuss national policy and how we might address reducing the prison population, sending people home to their families, is important to me.
What?
It's important to have that conversation with the media.
What do you think is the single most important thing you brought from prison life that you bring to the classroom?
Well, what I tell my students is that we need prisons. We need correctional officers. We just don't need as many prisons. That prison, some people need to be in prison. They need to get a wake-up call. They need to dry out. They need to overcome their drug addiction. They need to pay for their crimes. I just think that we have too many people, too many nonviolent first offenders in prison, and we have too many people in prison who are wasting away, deteriorating, because their sentences are much too long.
Connection listeners, what do you think? Does serving time make you more or less qualified to teach criminology? Our guest today, Professor Stephen Richards. Join the conversation with him and our other guest at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Judy Swallow, sitting in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. We're talking about convict criminology this hour. Still with us, Stephen Richards, ex-con and a professor of sociology and criminology at Northern Kentucky University. We're joined now by Mark Fleischer, who's director of the Center for Violence Prevention at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland. He's an anthropologist and a criminologist and author of Dead End Kids, Gang Girls, and the Boys They Know. He joins us from NPR in Washington, D.C. Mark Fleischer, do you agree with Professor Richards that what we're missing in criminology lecture halls are the personal stories?
You know, I made that argument for 10 years. As an anthropologist, I do a particular kind of anthropology. I'm an ethnographer. And one of the overriding objectives of doing ethnography, which I've done in prisons and on the streets with youth gang members, as in Beggars and Thieves, or Dead End Kids, I've done the same thing for many years in Seattle among adult criminals for a book I did called Beggars and Thieves. And it's interesting that when Steve was in the Federal Bureau of Prisons beginning in 1984, 1985, and 1986, I was working for the Federal Bureau of Prisons, and I was working in the cell houses at a federal penitentiary at Lompoc.
So your paths might have crossed, and you say you're an ethnographer.
That's
work
right.
Studying this, in quotes, alien culture known
That's
as
right.
the inmate society.
That's right. That's right. And the argument I made in the book, I went in to study at the behest of the Federal Bureau of Prisons. I went in to study stress and retention and burnout among new correctional officers, and I did that by training and becoming one. And when I left the institution, I wrote a book called Warehousing Violence. And in it, I talk about the socialization to a correctional officer point of view. I mean, there's a very powerful socialization force either for inmates or for staff. And being socialized into that subculture, as it were, really changes how you look at the world. And when I wrote the manuscript for Warehousing Violence, I wrote for 3 months, and then I went back and looked at what I wrote, and I threw it all away. Why? Because I considered it to be way too biased. I was writing from the point of view of being a line staff member in a federal penitentiary, rather than writing from the point of view of being an anthropologist, an ethnographer, and a social scientist.
So what you're arguing is you need the personal stories, but then you need to put your detached professorial hat back on, stand back, have a look at the research. And
absolutely, absolutely. Dead End Kids is my personal story that runs over 16 or 17 months with a youth gang. And at the time I was there in the mid-90s, nobody was over age 18. And this at the time was the most violent drug-based youth gang in Kansas City, Missouri. And the book is filled with personal stories. But the personal stories I used are personal stories that illustrate particular theoretical issues that are important in criminology. There are issues about child rearing, issues about the ineffectiveness of the juvenile justice system, issues about poverty and how communities don't address poverty, issues about how schools fail these kids. So the story becomes the example. The story isn't there to be a story in itself.
Professor Stephen Richards, what do you think about that, that if you're an insider, it's very hard to maintain your detachment as a researcher, possibly also as a professor?
Well, you know, Mark and I think have read each other's books, and I have enjoyed reading Mark's book, Warehousing Violence. Our books, Convict Criminology and the book Behind Bars, which were authored by myself and my co-author, Jeffrey Ian Ross, at the University of Baltimore. One of the reasons why I've got a co-author on these two books is because I wanted what I call a non-convict professor to be my co-author, so that to help make the books more scholarly and objective, to control for some of my biases as a former prisoner. But I should say the book Convict Criminology is very directly an autobiographical book. The book includes 9 chapters by ex-con professors, some of the biggest names in criminology.
But let's talk about your current research and your lecturing, getting inside jails. Do you think it's important for research that inmates actually know you've been inside? If you're actually investigating the prison system, does it help to be an insider?
Oh, it's a big help. I mean, the last study I just did with Jim Austin and Rick Jones, we had a study funded by the Soros Foundation where we went and interviewed in Kentucky parolees and prisoners. And Rick Jones is another ex-con professor at Marquette University. And we walked into the Kentucky prison system and interviewed in the cell blocks. And when we tell the prisoners that we're ex-cons and show them our former prison ID, they light up. I mean, they just want to talk to us. It just opens them up because they trust us, because we were prisoners just like them. So I think we get better interviews. I think we get more we get better data. And I think that allows us to write good research and good reports.
Mark Fleischer, what do you say to that? Do you ever feel shut out, that there's a certain barrier there?
Never. Over the years of the time that I have spent on the streets with kids and former inmates and the time that I've spent in institutions, I think I've acquired some special skill as an ethnographer that would allow me to become close to inmates even though I was not an inmate. For 2 years, the past 2 years, I did a study for the Office of Juvenile Delinquency or Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention, and I studied women in gangs in Champaign, Illinois. Well, I'm not a woman and I'm not in a gang, but I got some extraordinary data. Women I've known, young women I've known from about age 15 to age 23, 24, and I know their families, I know their aunties, I know their grandmothers, I know their brothers, I know their sisters, I know their stories, I know story families, and I've been in that particular community for 6 years, and people trust me. They trust me because I go back every day. They trust me because I do what I say. They trust me because I say that the police aren't going to know what they tell me, and that is true. And they trust me because we like each other. And I sure appreciate what Steve is talking about. Of course, there may indeed be a bond between folks who have shared that particular experience, in the same way that there may be a bond between folks who have shared the experience of being a correctional officer. And I've experienced that. You know, correctional officers are often difficult to get to know and difficult to talk to and sometimes standoffish. But as soon as you tell them you've worked the job and share experiences with them, they do indeed begin to talk.
Join the conversation, 800-423-8255, 800-43-TALK. Henry's calling from Cottageville, South Carolina. Hi, Henry.
Hello.
You're on the air.
Yes, I've wondered, I totally agree with the professor saying that being as an inmate, I was never in prison, never been incarcerated, but I was in the military and submarines, and if anybody's a submariner, they can immediately relate to this. We went 105 days without even seeing sunshine. So this is almost like solitary confinement. And if you do not have the empathy of the actual experience of being in this thing, standing and telling someone about this, they can't fully understand it. They don't know the feelings and how it is. And I fully believe that academia needs people with these experiences to relate it to people that are never had a contact with the law or ever even been in jail. So they have no concept of what it's like to be in this kind of a situation. And I fully believe that if we have these people that have the drive to educate themselves and then pass this knowledge on to other people, that there will be a better understanding, especially in the long-term sentences. Some of these, I do believe, are extremely unfair, but we're in a quandary right now. We have so many people breaking laws and drug laws that we're trying to crack down on, which, you know, there's a lot of debate on each side of it. But again, that's all basically what I have to put through.
I just have a quick question, though, Henry. Do you really believe that you could not explain to someone like me, or to Mark Fleischer, if you like, what it's like being in a submarine, the misery of it, that we'd really have had to live on a submarine for months on end to have any understanding of what you're talking about?
Yes, you would. I mean, your total lack of communications. You have no. You don't have any mail. You have no phone calls. You have no contact with other than 157 people day out, 24 hours a day. The unknowns of, you know, in prisons are going to have assaults in that. Our unknowns of dying, you know, really dying. The submarine have a catastrophic failure. Are we hitting something of this other nature? This all goes through your mind. And you actually become a fatalistic. People laugh about submariners because we have a odd sense of humor, and it's very dry and sometimes very dark, but you have to laugh about it. But in that situation, I was on a submarine. We was out for 105, like I said, 105 days, and we off and gone for 9 months out of port. We came back. We had 28 divorces, and just like you said, families were shattered because there was no interaction whatsoever.
We get the idea. It was very unpleasant, even if we don't really get the feeling of what it's like being on a sub. Look, Mark, what do you say to that? You need first-hand experience.
Well, I think it's time to introduce the idea that criminology is social science. Personal experience is great, But if personal experience stops at personal experience and stories around personal experience, it isn't social science, it's journalism. If personal experience can inform scientific method, if personal experience can inform scientific theory, if personal experience can add to the positivism of social science, then personal experience is good. But Steve and I have hundreds, if not thousands, of colleagues who don't have personal experiences in prisons or as inmates, and they do marvelous work.
Henry, thanks for your call. Let's throw it to Stephen. But Stephen, let you know that, there's nothing illegal about being on a submarine. What I want to get to, though, is how does your experience actually impact what you think should be said about rehabilitation in prison?
Well, first I should say I do think Mark is an excellent ethnographer, and we're both ethnographers. And there are many ethnographers, anthropologists, sociologists, that do quality work. And there are certainly academics that, because of their reading and their studying and their research over many years, gain intimate knowledge of the prison system. But having said that, I do think there's still something missing. I think that I think just having a prison experience and having that be part of your academic viewpoint is valuable. It's valuable in the classroom. It's valuable when you do research and go into prisons. It's valuable when you are writing up research reports and doing journal articles. Because you have to remember that we're not just talking here about categories, statistical categories, men, women, inmates, offenders. We're talking about real people with real lives and how their convictions and incarcerations, how that affects them.
Let's bring in Sean from Boston. 800-423-8255, of course. You want to get in touch with us and join the conversation. Sean, what's your point? You're a criminologist, I gather.
I am, in Boston, Massachusetts. The question is, I mean, this is not a new question in criminal justice. It's mostly framed in terms of, do you need to be a police officer or a correctional officer to be an effective instructor? Most of us have taken on as our responsibility to translate our applied research into the classroom experience and to inform our research. There's also the assumption that this discussion on system change is absent already. And it's interesting to note that most people that work in the system, in the system criticized academics for being too empathetic about what happens to offenders in the system.
And do you think having ex-cons as professors makes that worse?
No, I think it presents an interesting opportunity to expand the discussion. Have experience either as a professional or as an offender does, it helps people to inform their questions that they have. And then more importantly, how they interpret and understand what people tell them. I think it's an interesting opportunity, but not a prerequisite to be effective in the classroom or to be an effective researcher. If you pick up any criminal justice text worth its weight in salt, this idea of system change should be imbued in the whole thing.
Right. Professor Richards, what do you say to that? Too much about the offenders, too little about the victim?
Well, I think as a criminologist that we write about the victims too, and I think that our expertise is seeing it from a convict perspective. I teach a lot of courses at the university. Some courses are on prisons and courses on other subjects. And I've published widely on many different topics in criminology and criminal justice. So my focus is not totally on convicts and on that perspective.
What do you think about that, Mark? Mark Fleischer, too much concentration on the offender, not enough on the victim. Lots of criminology talk, but missing the point.
Well, it depends what you want to study. If you want to study victimology, that's one thing. If you want to study offenders, that's another. If you want to study the relationship, that's yet another. But if the conversation gets back to social science and how the work that Steve and I do influence our social science, there are some very important questions that need to be asked. And one of them is, how close is too close? How does going native, as we say in anthropology, influence your work? How native are you? Can you separate yourself from being native? Does being native influence your interpretations? But it all gets back again to theory, method, and then from there it gets back to generalizability. I guess the issue in my experiences and in Steve's experiences, and I don't mean to speak for him, is that perhaps a purely quantitative methodologist would say, are your personal experiences generalizable? How does this inform crime, criminal justice, prison management, and so on in the United States? How can you generalize from a sample of one to a sample of 2 million?
Professor Richards, how close is too close? A relevant question. The question is, how do you get that close without becoming an apologist for the criminal?
No, I agree with Mark. I mean, we're both ethnographers. The whole question is about our scientific method and what how we do science and doing good science. And to do that, you have to be able to first go into a situation, participate, study it, get to know it, as
but
Mark did when
you have
when
to remain objective, though.
Well, that, yeah, what you have to do is, I think as Mark explained, is you have to be able to pull back from that and then to be able to be objective and be able to write something that where you can generalize. Now, but I should say this. The convict criminology book was concertedly, very deliberately autobiographical. Very deliberately, because what we wanted to do in the book was have people tell their stories. And we did that because the book would be more readable. And I want to tell you, convict criminology has been widely adopted at universities all across the country because the students enjoy reading the autobiographical stories.
Connection listeners, question for you. Can only ex-cons understand the prison system? Join the conversation on 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Judy Swallow in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. We're talking about professors of criminology who spent time behind bars with us. Mark Fleischer, director of the Center for Violence Prevention at Case Western Reserve University, and Professor Stephen Richards, who's one of those professors, leading voices among the ex-convict criminologies, and also joining us, you, on 1-800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. Let's go to Joel in Fayetteville, North Carolina. Joel, what's your point?
Yes, Judy. I was just wondering, the entire criminal system, isn't it set up as a deterrent? And if you get too much of an influence from people that have been inside the system, it turns out being a deterrent to the deterrent, whereas you get this influx of kind of a pity party saying, oh, look how bad it is for us. But that's the point I think that youth need to get more of, how bad the system is, but not in a negative light as to where everyone feels that everyone in this being dehumanized.
Yeah, Professor Richards, isn't that a point? You go native, you've got too much sympathy.
Well, maybe, except that I think what the public needs to know is that it cost $100,000 to build one prison cell. It cost $25,000 a year to keep somebody locked up. We had over 2 million people in prison. The taxpayers are paying for it. And I don't think they're getting what they're paying for. When you've got a rate of recidivism and return that is something like 50% in 3 years, it's not a correctional system. I mean, it is a warehouse system. We're locking up people in prison. We're not doing much with them. We're not doing corrections. We're not rehabilitating them whatsoever. And then we keep them locked up for 5, 10, 20 years, and then we let them go and turn them loose on the community. And then they come back to prison. And it's a very expensive and I think in many ways a destructive system that is not improving the quality of life in our communities or neighborhoods.
Joe, what do you think about that? Not pitting the really rotten criminals, but, you know, an awful lot of people being locked up who shouldn't.
No, I agree that there are reforms that could be done to the system, but at the same time, there are some people that need to be warehoused. And maybe that's a very harsh word or term to use, but there are some people that need to be where they are. And are there reforms that need to be made? Absolutely. I absolutely agree with that. But the sense of making out that the system is this big, harsh, bad animal, I don't agree with that whatsoever.
Yeah, aren't you addressing a specific, Professor Richards, a specific group, which is really the white-collar guy, maybe the hippie in the 60s who smoked the odd joint who shouldn't have been banged up, in your view? You're not really talking about the real hard cases, are you?
No, actually, I agree with Joe. There are people that they need to be in prison. You know, people that who have done violent crimes and who they need to be locked up because they're a danger to the community. But I think that there's a million people in prison now that are not a danger to the community. They might need drug treatment. They might need some redirection in their life. They might need to learn how to make better choices. But it's very expensive to lock somebody up. And I think we should think twice about locking up nonviolent offenders.
Mark, what do you think about that? Does analyzing the system get clouded if sympathy is part of the equation?
I guess it depends on a research question. I think many people in America would argue that there are better ways to spend our tax dollars than keeping nonviolent drug offenders in institutions for 25 years. But prisons are also full, as Steve said, of extremely violent people, and they need to be out of the community. The issue is bigger than prison, though. The issue is even bigger than rehabilitation in prison. The issue is how best can offenders move back into the community and move into productive positions. But the more important issue is how do we prevent people from getting to prison to start with? I mean, it's rather ironic in this country that we spend almost no money on the poor, and then we're surprised when the poor go to prison.
Coincidentally, that's what David in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, wants to talk about. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
What's your point, David?
Well, I'm a former attorney and a multidisciplined business graduate who served 33 months in the federal prison system, and there's no doubt that an experience in the prison system adds depth, I believe, to any tutorial aspect a person would do, and I would assume also your research aspects. In my particular case, because of my education level, I served as a tutor in 9 different federal correctional institutions, and I've tutored before I went to prison, and I've tutored afterward, and I find that I'm a much better instructor, literally, for my prison experience, perhaps only because I can relate to a person who's more troubled educationally or economically than I was before I went.
Not many things you've missed there, and probably a better lawyer than them all, but look, what do you think is being missed in this conversation? What's being missed in the system?
Well, I think you touched on two. First of all, is if we've spent $200 billion on prisons around the nation, I think that's a realistic number, then perhaps some of that $200 billion could have better been on preventing the crimes themselves, and that's a socioeconomic issue that I've firmly believe in. And secondly, I believe that once we've lost that battle and we find ourselves with 2.2 million incarcerated individuals, I find they break into three she's, those that are recidivistic, and no matter what we do there, they're going to return there, and essentially there it's a warehousing function. Secondly, the group such as myself who, upon arrest, was rehabilitated, apologetic, remorseful, reimbursable, that person needs not to be warehoused in any way, needs to be outside of the prison walls in halfway houses, monitored programs, ankle bracelets, and forced to contribute, as I was forced to contribute, in some societal meaningful way. And then the third group, which is the most critical, is those people that are on the cusp. They could go either way. They could become recidivistic, or they could be gainful. My family company has offered employment and housing to inmates when they get out, and we find great success on just providing a steady job and a domicile place in their first 6 months out of jail. And I don't think we've had any one of those 11 people go back to jail yet.
Can I ask you, though, David? I mean, as I said, you've been through just about every the prison system from every point of view, you know, gamekeeper and poacher. But what you said there, that prevention is socioeconomic, I mean, you could learn that in any classroom, not from an ex-con, sure. That an important thing is to sort of screen out the nonviolent offenders, the kids who just got into a bit of trouble and should never go to jail because they're going to be destroyed. You could learn that in a classroom as well. What does having been on the inside actually add to your understanding?
The gravity or the gravamen of the incarceration experience. It tangentially touched on your submarine caller. It is a unique experience, and there is severe punishment merely in separation and in segregation in the prison experience. And that does, we have not completely vocalized in our country the gravity of that punishment. And I think that the experience itself, therefore, lends that common depth of perception.
Mark Fleischer, what do you say to that?
I can't argue with it. Going to prison adds a depth of perspective. But there's another issue that we have to raise, that is about the nature of prison and how prison fits into the lives of people who keep going back to prison. I have argued that prison isn't simply an epicycle in the lives of men and women who continue to go back to institutions, that prisons play an important role in their lives. We have research to show that inmates leave prison a lot healthier when they went in. We know, and Steve said this, we know that people who have been using substances to excess on the outside go into institutions and they dry out. We know that people who failed at school do better at school. We know that people get job skills, and those job skills are highly effective on the outside to reduce recidivism. The Federal Bureau of Prisons Research Office has demonstrated this in their work. Prisons are important. And it's also equally important for taxpayers to know that prisons aren't evil dungeons. Prisons are run by, prison systems are run by very smart, very caring people who plan and try to spend the money in exactly the right way, who try to do the best they can do with limited money and expanding prison populations.
And they do have rotating doors. Stephen Richards, from your experience inside, do you have more of an insight into how you stop this recidivism, apart from having all the ex-cons become professors, of course? I mean, how do you actually stop that rotating door?
Well, you know, what Mark is saying is, I think, in some part true. Except that our experience is back in the 1980s. Here we are in the year 2003, and the federal prison system has become a vast warehouse. The system is just too big, and although you have some caring correctional administrators and officers that would like to help inmates to better their education and their job skills so that they would not return to prison, what's happened is that most of the good programs, the college programs, vocational programs, have been severely cut. Prisoners are now being basically warehoused in vast buildings, locked down. More of them are in the hole. More of them are in solitary. They're building a lot more penitentiaries, supermaxes. The conditions of confinement are much worse today than they were in the 1980s.
Let's take one quick call before we go from Emily calling from Jamaica Plain. Emily, what would you like to ask our guests?
I have two quick related questions. I'm happy to take the answer off the air. The questions are about human subjects considerations, or in more plain language, how you as researchers went about complying with laws about how to conduct the research that you've done. And I'm specifically interested in any special steps that you had to take to protect prisoners' rights when conducting the research. And then for Mark, I have a strong interest in finding out how it was that you were able to provide assurance to your subjects that you wouldn't report crimes to the police, and how you got permission from your institution to do that. Thank you.
Emily, thanks a lot. Two quick questions. Stephen, how did you protect prisoners' rights?
Well, both Mark and I, all ethnographers, all social scientists, have to go before a human subjects committee at their university to get permission to actually do the research. And we have to have a statement of confidentiality that every interviewee signs. We have to protect their identities. We have to delete from their interviews any identifying information.
Okay, Mark, same thing with you, that you protect them, you protect your interviewees by basically granting them anonymity before you go into the research.
Oh, absolutely, sure. I mean, an institutional review board looks carefully at the risk the research poses, at the benefits the research pose, and how we're going to maintain the rights of individuals in the institution and also on the street. And, of course, we use volunteers.
One quick question for both of you, very briefly, if you would. You both agreed all through this program, jails are too full, wrong people are being put in, there's too much recidivism, there's not enough prevention. Mark, briefly, what do you do?
Stop arresting so many people for nonviolent crimes. I mean, the answer that I have is no different from the answer anybody else has who's a criminologist or a sociologist. You have to do something about poverty. You have to do something about schools because schools are pushing the wrong people to the street where they commit crimes. We have to do something about vocational employment. And we have to do something about job retention. You have to do something about medical care. I mean, these are all social problems.
We've got to put the whole world right. But Stephen Richards, a quick view from the inside.
Well, to go back to Emily's question there about how we do science, that's the difference, you see. Both Mark and I, we might be inside a prison interviewing prisoners. But if Mark is employed by the Federal Bureau of Prisons, the prisoners may be somewhat suspicious that he may share information with the BOP. When I'm an ex-con, they don't have that concern.
Professor Richards, thanks very much indeed. Professor Stephen Richards, Professor of Sociology and Criminology at Northern Kentucky University, also co-editor of Convict Criminology. My other guest, Mark Fleischer, director of the Center for Violence Prevention at Cape Western Reserve University in Cleveland, and author of Dead End Kids, Gang Girls and the Boys They Know. My thanks to you both. Connection listeners, you can continue the conversation on our website, theconnection.org. The Connection's produced by Khalil Bird, Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Lane Grant, Kelly Jones, Orit Koritsky-Fox, Jen Mattson, Lindsay Miller, Christina Russo, and Doug Shugarts. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. I'm Judy Swallow, filling in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
The war on drugs is really warring the youth, warring the people, warring the truth. The violent crimes rise, the silence dies, the sirens cry through the night. People fight for what's left and not what's right. In the prison industrial complex, you got taxes, politics, jobs, death, gross, stunning, cold-blooded, dark and heartless. From the pyramids down to the projects. In the prison industrial complex, you got taxes, politics, jobs, death, gross, stunning, cold-blooded, dark and heartless. From the pyramids down to the projects. Word is bomb.